I still want to say a few things about the mapping class group, and a certain amount of background actually fits into both discussions. So I'm gonna continue the background a little bit more. So let me first remind you what we did last time. So we had this marking graph. Where a marking is this just enough data to tie down a surface. So for example, if I do this, three curves like this, and then three transversals, so I think that's what you get in this picture, for example, that's called a marking. And there are elementary moves, and so edges, vertices are marking, edges are elementary moves. This thing is quasi-asymmetric to the mapping class group. So that was one construction. And the other thing was subsurface projections. So this was a map from, given an essential subsurface in S, you have a map from curves in S to curves in W, with the addition of the empty set in case you have no intersection. And this, and the picture that goes with this definition is this, that you have, this is W, and this is my curve which does cross W. And so on. Then the image is some choice like this. You take one of these arcs and you do surgery at the boundary, and you get you can always do this to get a non-trivial arc in W, and it's quasi well defined. So this map I'll call pi W, and it has, I talked a little bit about the various properties it has, but the main thing is just that it's there's arbitrary choices which don't change the answer by more than a bounded distance. And also, the map is essentially Lipschitz. If you look at two points that are with non-empty image, which are distance one apart here, then their images will be distance two at most. You might get a different curve. Yeah, I had a choice here. I could have gone around the back. I could have also chosen a different green arc to do it with. All of these different choices yield things which are at most distance two from each other. So, okay. So these are sort of the two sort of basic tools that keep coming up. And then I wanted to talk about this distance formula. So for markings. And so let me talk a little bit more about this. And in order to talk about this, I want to explain a little bit how you go from information in the curve complex to information in the marking graph. So suppose I have two points in the marking graph, so two markings, and I want to find a good path between these two points. So I want a path which is efficient between these two points. So this is always the problem with these lectures, that this is actually sort of a long story to describe this. But so I always make some shortcut. So here's, so let me, I'll start to describe this, and hopefully you'll get the idea of it. So first of all, so what is this again? It's a Pantz decomposition with some transversal data. So if you just think of the Pantz decomposition associated with mu, it's just a maximal simplex in the curve complex. So let's just draw that part of the picture. Okay, this is the base of mu. And then somewhere else in the curve complex is the base of mu. And I want to go from here to there by some sequence of elementary moves. And I also have this, think of the transversal data, the red stuff, as some kind of decoration of this simplex. And I'm going to mostly ignore that in this discussion, although you can kind of make everything work with taking that into account, too. So how do I get from here to there? Well, I go by a straight line. So I pick a point here, and I just go as fast as I can to here in the curve complex. So here is the beginning of the construction. So let's pick a geodesic in the complex of curves. Let's call that G1, maybe, in the one skeleton of the complex of curves, connecting a point here to a point there. Well, that's not enough information to give me elementary moves from here to there. So how do I then turn this into a sequence of elementary moves? So it turns out that there's this kind of bottom-up construction, that slowly fills in the picture until at the end I have a sequence of elementary moves. So I'll just give you a sample of how this might work. Let's just look at a local picture, a local part of the picture. What do I see here? If I have, say, vertex A, B, and C, what do I see in the surface? I see the following picture, some picture like this. So maybe this is B. And then A and C are disjoint from B, and they have to intersect each other. So they must look something like this. So here's A maybe on one side, and C is also on the same side, and they intersect each other in some perhaps very complicated way. Okay? So that's C. So I can think of these two. So if I call this surface W, okay, then I've got two points in the curve complex of W, A and C. So in the curve complex of W, it's like looking at this picture with a microscope. In the curve complex of W, I see A and C. And they are going to be, let's call this G2 maybe. They're connected by some geodesic in the one skeleton of the curve complex of W. Okay? So I'm going to just draw that in this picture. So all of these points live in W, so they're all distance 1 from B. So I'm allowed to do this picture, to do this. I'll just draw this geodesic over here, and every one of these vertices actually is attached to B by an edge. Okay? So as long as the surface W is not a one-hole torus or a four-hole sphere, it's legitimate to draw this picture and to have these edges be actual edges. Not only are they in the curve complex of W, but they're actually in the curve complex of the whole thing, and these are actual symplices in my original curve complex. Okay? So I'm going to just do this. I'll do it everywhere. So between here, I'll do it also. And so on. And so what I've got now, it kind of looks like a collection of triangles that are traveling from one side to the other, and that's really what it is. And then if I want to complete the picture, I keep doing this. So, for example, I'll go here, and all of this is taking place inside W, but inside W, I have inductively the same picture, and I can put in another collection of edges like this, and all these guys in here are disjoint from this point, so I can draw edges, but they're also still disjoint from this one. So really, I now have a higher dimensional picture. Now I've got a bunch of three symplices, or actually, it's elementary moves between two symplices. Here I had edges, which are connected by moves, and here I have triangles, which are connected by moves, and I can keep filling in this picture. So I fill in inductively by geodesics at every level, and this is what we call a hierarchy of geodesics, with various there are various caveats about this construction. It's not exactly like this. Well, there are technical caveats about what kind of paths I can use here. I don't just use any geodesic. There are also there's the caveat I mentioned in the beginning about I didn't explain what to do about the transversals. That part of the discussion gets filled in a similar way. And I also didn't say what happens at the endpoints. Somehow this construction I described works very nicely when you're in the interior of a geodesic. But as I put in more and more of this picture, I have to come to grips with the fact that all these geodesics have endpoints. And at endpoints, something different happens, and it's actually more complicated. But there's a way to do it. And in the end, you actually do get a sequence of elementary moves that sort of passes through this picture and connects mu to nu. Okay? Okay, so this is called a hierarchy. What, this fan here, the first one? Why did I draw a fan like that, you mean? Let's see. Well, so what I just, the point was just that I was working in a subsurface to make this picture. So again, the picture was, the local picture at the very first step looked like this. Okay? And then in the complement of B, both of these lie in the complement of B, so I'm sitting in some subsurface in the complement of B, and it has its own curve complex, which is still connected. So I just choose a shortest path. So this is now the microscopic picture in the curve complex of the subsurface. And that is exactly what I've put here. I've just taken that and then transplanted it into this picture. Okay? And then I continue that process. Okay? So, well, that never happens. That never happens because if that was true, they would be distance 1 apart, and this wouldn't be a geodesic. Okay. So, But it's a good question. And there are other issues like this which come up, which for which reason you have to actually tighten this picture a little bit. But basically, this is the idea. All right, so. Yeah, that's right. In the marking graph, right. So I didn't exactly construct a path in the marking graph. What I constructed first, it just looks like a whole bunch of stuff, right? But then I claim that there's some kind of a partial order to this picture. I mean, it looks like there's a total order, like you just do everything from left to right, but that's not quite true, because it could happen that some part of the picture is in some surface W, and another part gets built in a surface Z, which is disjoint from W, and then it turns out you can sort of independently do one first or the other first. So there's various... what there really is here is there's some kind of a partially ordered structure which can be turned into a family of slices that move monotonically from left to right, respecting this partial order. But that's not a unique thing. There are different paths here. In the same way that if you try to move on a unit grid in the plane, okay, if I want to get from here to there, I can use horizontal and vertical moves sort of interchangeably to get from here to there. So that the geodesic from here to there is not unique, but the structure is unique that I'm looking at. That's sort of what's happening here also. Because, there's lots of stuff I didn't show you in here, but so something happened in W and I put in a geodesic in W, okay? If you keep filling things in, you'll discover at some point that something will happen in the complement of W2. And you'll fill stuff, and there'll be two curves that pop up in this picture in the complement of W, and you have to join them by geodesic 2, and so it sort of shows up somewhere in this picture. But then if you try to move from left to right, you can sort of move things, in, you can progress in this geodesic or in that geodesic independently, because things in disjoint surfaces are independent of each other. Okay, that's roughly the idea. There's a lot of, another way to say this, there are a lot of product regions inside M. And when you go through a product region, you have exactly this kind of non-uniqueness that shows up. Okay, so there's no way to really avoid this, because the only question is how do you deal with it. So that's the construction. Let me point out a couple of things about it. One is that, let me just go back to the initial thing that we looked at. Okay, if you look at this picture, so this is A, and this is C, and this is B, right? So one can ask is, how do I figure out what the size of this construction is? How long is this geodesic that I have to put in here? What can I say about that? So I can say the following thing about it. I can say that we had this lemma about this. Yeah, let me remember this lemma. So there's this projection bound lemma, which I claimed was important. So here is a place where it's important. It says that, suppose that gamma is a geodesic in C of F with vertices C1 of S, always in one's column, vertices gamma I, and suppose that gamma I intersect W for all I. Whoops. Then the statement is that if you take all the stuff and project it using pi W into W, you will get a diameter. So the diameter in C of W of gamma, which means the projection of gamma, is bounded by some uniform constant. So there exists such a constant. Okay, so that this is sort of a fundamental fact for this discussion. So if I try to apply that fact over here, what do I see? So if you look at this geodesic, it actually breaks up. You can break it up into this initial part and the final part, and then B in the middle. And note that every vertex here intersects. They all intersect W. And the same thing is true for every vertex afterwards. Because, well, A intersects W, because it's in W. Everything else here is distance at least 2 from B, so it intersects B, so it intersects W, because B is the boundary of W. Okay, same thing happens on this side. So this whole thing, this whole geodesic segment, its projection to W has bounded diameter. Okay? And the same thing happens for this one. So what that means, and on the end here, there's mu, and on the end here, there's mu. So what we get out of this is that the distance in W between mu and nu is almost the same thing as the distance in W between A and C. So I guess the exact statement is that this minus this is bounded by twice this diameter bound. So you could have predicted, just by looking at the endpoints, how big this geodesic would have to be when it got constructed, okay? Because of this bound. And in fact, more is true, so there's another kind of, using the same logic, you just kind of play around with this picture a bit, there's another theorem which says, well, there's just a different number, let's call it M prime, such that if this number is sufficiently large, then, in fact, W does have to show up. W must show up in the hierarchy. Okay? It's actually almost an exercise. I'll just leave this unproven. But this says that somehow that the surfaces for which these numbers are large are important in the sense that they're forced to show up, and when they do show up, you know how important they are because you have this estimate on how long these geodesics are. Okay? So, well, first of all, so once you're done making this construction, this hierarchy has some size, which is basically the sum of the lengths of all the pieces. Okay? That sort of tells you how many moves it takes to go from the beginning to the end using this picture. So the size of the hierarchy is essentially the sum. You have to worry about what this means, but it's the sum over all the W that participate in this picture of this distance between the endpoints projected into the subsurface. So there's some kind of accounting statement here. What does this twiddle mean? This twiddle means, so x twiddle y means that x is less than ay plus b for some fixed a and b, and y is less than ax plus b. Okay, for where these guys are supposed to be uniform constants. So up to some kind of distortion, the size of the hierarchy is the same as the number of domains is the sum of the sizes for the domains that participate. And the theorem I stated sort of tells you which domains participate, at least which domains participate in an important way. And so, in fact, you can turn this into the following sort of the count, which I actually wrote last time, which is you take the sum over all W's, and then you decide whether they participate by looking at the size of this number. So then I do this threshold notation. Okay? Where this, again, this means... where this means that it's x if x is bigger than or equal to k, and it's 0 otherwise. Okay, so you throw away everything that's not big enough to k is m prime. Yeah. Actually, k is anything. This is true for any k bigger than m prime. You can get such an estimate. So you can throw away the junk that doesn't quite count. This is not a trivial statement, actually, because maybe each individual maybe there are many W's left out of this because they don't quite make it past the threshold, but maybe there's so many of them that they do matter in this sum. So the part of this statement is that they don't. There's some kind of counting argument that says that they don't matter. Okay, but this is the distance formula I wanted. Well, this is not quite a distance formula. This says that the hierarchy has roughly this size, and then you also have to... you have to prove that the distance in the marking graph between mu and u is estimated by the size of this hierarchy. In other words, this construction is efficient in some way. Okay? That's not obvious either. You started with the most efficient first level of this, right? And every level you added something which was also the most efficient thing you could do. It's kind of the greedy algorithm for building something. But maybe if you'd done a sort of bad choice in the very beginning, you might have then had lots of very good choices afterwards, right? So it's not so obvious that this is the best thing to do. But it turns out that it's within the constant, within bounded distortion, it is the best thing to do. Okay, so that's the basic machinery of hierarchies and markings and why you can control distance in the marking graph. let's see, how much... So I wanted to at least state a theorem. I guess I stated a theorem, but I wanted to... Let me say maybe 5 minutes worth of stuff about this rank conjecture. So if you look at... So the claim is... this is a theorem I stated last time. Which says that the geometric rank equals algebraic rank for the module for the mapping class group. And we know what the algebraic rank is. So the algebraic rank is essentially the same as the number of curves in a Pansky decomposition. Okay, which is the same as the rank of the largest abelian subgroup you can embed, you can find inside the mapping class group. And then the geometric rank, so for this there's a formula, the geometric rank is the largest R such that there exists a quasi-isometric embedding. Well, let's use M here into the marking graph. So it turns out that one direction of this is easier. It still requires some work, but actually that comes from a paper with Farb and Lubotsky. But it more or less uses the machinery here. But essentially, which way is easier? So the geometric rank is greater than or equal to the algebraic rank. Is relatively easy. In other words, you have to show that the subgroups that any abelian subgroup is actually quasi-isometrically embedded. It's not too distorted. Okay, so let me leave that alone. And so there are groups in which you can find. Yeah. So actually, there's a nice paper on this by Lubotsky, Moses, and Raghunathan. About when this kind of thing happens, but one example in this paper is that in SL2Z, no, sorry, in SL3Z, there exist Z2s, unipotent Z2s inside SL3Z, which are not quasi-isometrically embedded in the group. It can happen in other groups, right? This is one of the ways in which this group is different from these other groups. Yeah. So.
This,
yeah, it sits like this. It's So we're in SL3Z, and it's I think it's sort of this or something. I forget. It's one of these subgroups.
You were identifying it rather than putting it next.
Right. Okay. So yeah. So it's not trivial there's some group like this in here would have to be quasi-symmetric, and it's not in general. So but here they are. So the issue really becomes, how do we get an upper bound? So could there be a ZR, which is too big, with R is too big, which is quasi-symmetrically embedded inside this group? And that's the thing that you have to rule out. So maybe let me say a little bit about it. So how do we approach this problem? One natural way to approach this problem is the following. Suppose you did have a Z to the R, for some R, embedded inside M, okay? So you could do the following thing. You could take this is a metric space, and this is a metric space. So you can form a new metric space by taking the old metric space and multiplying the metric by epsilon. So here, epsilon is some small number. So you still have two metric spaces. And if this was a quasi-isometry with a multiplicative constant of A and an additive constant of B, so this is describing the error, right? The error has the error between distances in here and distances in here involves multiplying by A and adding B. Okay? Then if you multiply the whole picture by epsilon, then here the quasi-isometry would be still a multiplicative constant is A, but the additive constant becomes epsilon B. Okay? And These are still infinite diameter spaces, even though you multiply them by epsilon. So now you let epsilon go to zero. This idea is more or less the Gromov, that you can let epsilon go to zero. So I guess letting epsilon go to zero is an older concept. But but in this setting, what would happen to this metric space if you let epsilon go to zero? You're going to get a finer and finer grid. And so if you take your glasses off, then you see that this is converging to the Euclidean space, okay, in the limit. And you've got an embedding of this Euclidean space into something, and I'll just call this M sub omega, and I won't say what it is because it's actually hard to understand. But there's some kind of way of taking a limit of an arbitrary metric space as you let epsilon go to zero. This is what's called an ultra limit. So you have to kind of be careful. You have to use the axiom of choice, but you get some object which kind of encodes all the limiting behavior in this metric space as you shrink it.
Well, this is unique, right? I mean, many of them are coming out with all equally good.
That's right. So one of the issues you deal with is, you know, that there are many ways of taking ultra limits, right? And I think they depend on. I think there are theorems that, you know, in which the validity of the continuum hypothesis, I think, affects whether or not there are different limits. So you're getting into not sort of territory I normally play in. But nevertheless, you can make this machinery work, and you can get some kind of a limit. And now, so this is very important, that A, the limit of A is still A, but the limit of epsilon B as epsilon goes to zero is zero. This is due to Gromov. Okay, so this becomes a bi-Lipschitz embedding. And so, to rule out a bi-Lipschitz embedding of R to the R, essentially what you're asking is, I mean, a good way to try to do that is to say, can I bound the topological dimension of this space? This is now the interesting thing about this whole process is that you can turn coarse geometry into topology. Okay, and now that what you really want to bound is the dimension of this space. If you can show that dimension is bounded above by the number you're looking for, then you get a bound on R. Okay, so let me give you a quick description of how you might do this, and I'll do it. I'll do it in a special case because then I can just draw a few pictures, and hopefully you'll believe me. So let's consider my favorite example. This is the sphere with five holes. Okay, this is the first example where something interesting happens. So here the rank I'm looking for should be 2, because I can put 2 disjoint curves in a Pansky composition. Okay, so I want to show that R is at most 2. So let's build something in M of F and think about it for a minute. So let's fix a curve in the complex of curves and look at, we'll call it Q of delta is the set of markings whose base contains delta. In other words, here is delta. All deltas are actually equivalent under the mapping class group, so it doesn't matter which delta I choose for this. Pick some delta, and then look at all markings in which delta is a curve in the marking, and then there's some other curve. And then you add transversals. Okay? So actually, let's do this. Sorry, let's do it. So here's 2 curves, one of which is delta, and then there's some transversal data. One looks like this, maybe. The other one, I'll kind of draw it schematically. The other one looks like this. It sort of, each of them tells us how much twisting we should have. Okay, so some object like this is a marking. Look at all such markings, and that gives you Q of delta. And Q of delta is basically, up to quasi-isometry, the following thing. It's basically Z cross M of S04. Because if you think about what you can do in these markings, delta is fixed for you. You can change how much twisting there is around delta. There's a Z's worth of that. You can also change whatever happens in the complement of delta, and there's that's a four-hole sphere. Okay, so it turns out if you look at the distance formula and you play around with it a little, it's not so hard to see that this is actually a quasi-isometry, this parametrization. It's not a group theoretic parametrization. The stabilizer of delta is not a product of these two groups, but there's a short exact sequence which gives similar information. So we have this, and this is more or less the same as Z cross SL2Z because that's more or less what this is. And then we can sort of understand what this looks like in the limit when we rescale. So epsilon q delta q of delta converges to, well, when you rescale this by epsilon, what you get is R cross something. And what is the something? Well, SL2Z is virtually free. Okay, up to finite index, this is essentially the free group on two generators whose Cayley graph is a tree. So this thing is the limit of trees under rescaling. If you take a tree and rescale it by epsilon, you'll get a really, really thick tree. Right? You'll get a sort of tree with lots and lots of branching. What you get in the limit is an R tree, which is a metric space, but essentially it's like a tree, except it can have dense branching everywhere. And this is the good thing about this is that its topological dimension is one. It's a one-dimensional object. So I've got this subset which looks like an R, like a product of two one-dimensional things, so it's two-dimensional, so that's good. So think of a tree cross R, so it sort of looks like there's a tree direction, and there's an R direction, and there's this product structure. Well, that's certainly a two-dimensional object, but the trouble is that there are lots of these inside this R limit, because not only can I do this, I can actually take any sequence of deltas, for example, and I can form the Q of delta n's, and then I can take epsilon n going to 0, and I can take limits of anything like this, and I'll get some object inside this rescale limit. So there's actually uncountably many of these things all fitting together inside this very large space, so it's not so clear what we can say about the whole space. So there's one. So you have to prove something. So here's the thing I want to prove. So there exists a map. This is a little bit like we call it pi delta, from the marking graph to Z. Okay? So it's this Z. A given delta, you have this Z. And this map is just like the pi W we talked about before, but what it does is, it sort of does, intuitively, it's doing the following thing. If you have delta here, if you have any marking, some part of the marking must cross delta, and when it crosses, it has some kind of a twisting amount that you want to quantify. And that's what Z is, okay? That's what this map does. So it measures twisting. And it has the following property. It has the property that if mu is a marking which is not in Q of delta, and there exists a number rho less than 0 and another number m greater than 0, rho less than 1, with the following property, that if you look at pi delta of a ball around mu of radius rho times the distance from mu to Q, okay, then the diameter of that, this is now a subset of Z, right? So the diameter of it is bounded by M. So the picture is this. We have this product region. I'm drawing it. So imagine that here's the R direction, and here's the tree direction, which I'm kind of drawing like a disk, but it's really an infinite tree. And then if I'm outside of this somewhere, and somewhere else in this space, I measure this distance, R. And if I take a ball of size rho r, so it's strictly less than r, then the image of that whole ball when I project it onto the z is bounded. Okay? It's a little bit like, there are similar statements about in hyperbolic spaces, but this is a little finer because I have to worry about this product region. So the proof of this is done using the same distance formula tools that I described before. You have to sort of to look a little more deeply into the structure, but it's not hard to prove this. Once you figure out that's the thing you want to prove, it's not hard to prove it. But the nice thing about this is that you can rescale this statement and go to the limit. So now rescale by epsilon, and what's the statement I get? Well, I have this map Q, let's call it Q omega, this limit of the Qs, which sits inside M. I have this Z, which has become an R. So the Q is basically R cross T, like before. And I have a projection to R, so I have pi from the rescaled space to R. And it has the following property. It says that pi is locally constant in the complement of Q. Because this says that if I'm a certain distance, then I can go a certain fraction of that distance and still have a bounded image. Now rescale everything. The bound becomes zero because I'm rescaling. And this says that there's some neighborhood, non-trivial neighborhood, where everything gets mapped to the same point. So this gives you information, because now this tells you, this is like a topological exercise, but it immediately follows that if you look at a cross section, point cross T, inside R cross T, well, that separates R cross T, because the point separates R, right? But this statement implies that this actually separates globally. The things that, so there's P, there's everything in M which lands to the left of P, and everything in M which lands to the right of P, and you can't get from one side to the other unless you go through the fiber over P. Everything else, everywhere else, you can't move at all. This projection just can't move at all if you're not inside our product region. So this thing that separates the product region actually separates the whole space. And now suppose that E is some embedded R3 inside M. Okay, and suppose that pi restricted to E is not constant. Then what would I get? So if E is some 3 space in this picture, which sits somewhere and its projection onto this line is not constant, it immediately follows, well, a contradiction follows, because this means that E is separated by some P cross T. Okay, but this is dimension 1, and this is dimension 3. And, well, you need a lemma here of some sort. You need to know that you can't separate R3 by a tree. Okay, because it's got codimension 2. So this is topological dimension, and this isn't a very nice set, but still, this is a contradiction. Okay, so... It's a closed set. It's a closed intersection of an R tree with, so it's an R tree or a union of, anyway, some. So it's a complete metric space. Yeah. So there's reasonable. I mean, dimension theory works in this setting. Okay. Okay, and then to actually finish the proof, you have to show that you have to get enough of these pies so that for every. In fact. You have to get enough pies so that they separate every pair of points. There's some lemma that actually turns out to be the easy part, to show that for any 2 points, you can find a pie which separates them so that the images are different. So any that means for any flat, there's some pie which is not constant on it, and then that bounds the dimension of the flat. Okay. So that's the idea of this proof. Okay, now I promise to talk about hyperbolic geometry. But the lucky thing is that a lot of the things I already said are relevant to the question of 3 manifolds. So let me just sort of say a few things about what's going on in hyperbolic geometry. What do we need to know about? What is my favorite question in hyperbolic geometry? Let's put it that way. So suppose that, if you have a hyperbolic 3 manifold, then Mostar rigidity says that if if the volume of M is finite, actually it's Mostar Prasad rigidity, then the geometric structure is unique. Okay, even for closed manifolds, Mostar rigidity, right? So if we have a closed manifold which is hyperbolic, then there's a one unique hyperbolic structure. And Perelman's work tells us that we know topologically when such a structure exists, that Thurston's geometrization conjecture is true. But a question that's still worth asking is this: can we make this effective? So, in other words, given a topological description of M, I want to actually build some geometric description. Okay? So there are various, of course, various settings where one can actually do this. For example, if you're given a knot, then you can apply this program Snappy by Jeff Weeks to find triangulations and hyperbolize them and so on, and to the extent that I think there are issues of exactly how rigorous this is, but certainly this is a practical way of finding hyperbolic structures. but it's hard to find kind of a general scheme which works and is understood and one can use. So so let me give you some particular settings where we know what to do and explain how they tie into things. So a nice, interesting, rich class of hyperbolic three manifolds is the ones that fiber over the circle. So suppose that M fibers over the circle with fiber some surface. This is determined by a monodromy map, say phi. And when it's pseudo Anosov, so I'm going to not define these terms. I figure everybody who has lasted this long knows what pseudo Anosov means. Okay. Although, so I was told once about a story about a three-manifold topology. I don't know who it was who, when asked to explain what an Anosov map is, he said, "Well, it's like pseudo Anosov, but without the singularities." So of course, this data determines the hyperbolic structure abstractly, and I want to claim that first of all, there is a way to actually determine it concretely, or depending on what you mean by concretely, if you have a description of phi. And so the connection I want to make is this: if phi, what does phi determine combinatorially? It determines an axis in the complex of curves. So I want to just tie this into the combinatorial discussion. So in our complex of curves, there's some line which is, well, it's quasi-invariant by this. Everything is a quasi-statement that I make. But so this thing, when you act on this by phi, up to some bounded error, it just takes it to itself. And the endpoints are the laminations associated to the pseudo-Anosov stable laminations. And in fact, remember that the boundary at infinity of C of S was a space of laminations, and it's exact. That's consistent with this picture. And then if we do this hierarchy construction, you sort of fill this in. So you get this. Now it's an infinite hierarchy construction, right? But locally finite. You get some picture, and in this picture you get a bunch of markings and so on. And this picture is a good reflection of the geometry of the three manifold. For example, all markings that show up in this hierarchy have bounded lengths in M, for example, where the bound is uniform, independent of anything but the surface S. So there's a universal bound, once you fix the fiber, that tells you that an a priori bound on the length of every vertex that shows up in this picture has a length in the three-manifold, and that length is bounded. Okay, so that tells you something about the relationship between the two things. And furthermore, there's the hierarchy encodes everything, really. It encodes the injectivity radius, the set of very short curves, set of what are called Margulis tubes. So all the color neighborhoods of extremely short curves. It sort of tells you everything. In fact, there is a recipe for, given this picture, building a bi-Lipschitz model of the three manifold, where the uniformity of the bi-Lipschitz uniformity depends only on the surface S. So this is all of this is part of. So this comes from the solution of the any lamination conjecture. Um, with Brock Canary. And so there's what this is a scheme for understanding the geometry of how surfaces map into three manifolds using the complex of curves. Maybe I should say, sort of to tie this in, what's kind of the basic lemma that starts you going when you try to understand this stuff? The basic lemma is this. So it says this. If F from S to M, M now is any hyperbolic three manifold and S is a surface, if this is pi 1 injective, then if you look at the set of all elements in the complex of curves, which have the property that the length in M of their images is bounded by some a priori constant. Okay, fix some a priori constant. Look at all the elements in the complex of curves, which in the three manifold have that length bound. So what this means is, what do I really mean here? Let's put a little star here. So I really mean, take the curve in the surface, map it by the map, and then find the shortest representative, because maybe the map is not. It's just really, I really want to think of this as a homotopy class. Okay? So this set is quasi-convex in C. Okay? That's sort of what gets you started, because this relates in some way the geometry in the three manifold with the geometry in the complex of curves. And this is proven using pleated surfaces. So this is, I guess all I can do is give you hints as to what things I mentioned in the first lecture. So remember that for any curve I can, or any disjoint set of curves, I can build a pleated surface which realizes those curves. So let's call the set something. Let's call it X. Okay. So let me give you a 30-second proof of this theorem. Okay. So there's a map from the curve complex to X, which depends on our F, which works as follows. Given an element in the curve complex, you construct a pleated surface, say H gamma, which is homotopic to F. Okay? It has a hyperbolic metric, right? Remember that every pleated surface pulls back a hyperbolic metric to the surface. And in the hyperbolic metric, find the shortest curve on the surface now. So now I'm back. I started with the curve. I built a surface in the three manifold. I looked in the surface. I found the shortest curve. We'll call that beta. And that is the definition of this map. So pi of gamma is beta. Okay? So you'll know two things about this, which are a recurring theme. The only thing I know how to do is build maps that are like projections that are called pi. That's step. And even when I know how to define a map called pi, I don't really know how to define it because there are always arbitrary choices. So there are many pleated maps, and given one pleated map, there's more than one shortest curve, typically. So this is not really a map, it's kind of a construction, but it turns out that the main point actually is that it doesn't matter how you make these choices. You still get something reasonable when you do this. And this map acts like a projection. So pi is coarsely a nearest point retraction. Well, actually, we don't need nearest point, just the Lipschitz retraction to X. And this, plus the hyperbolicity of the complex, implies that X is quasi-convex. Okay, so this gives you a feeling for how there's a relation between the hyperbolic geometry and the geometry of the complex. Not really out of time. So I want to maybe leave you with just one more picture. So this is, again, this is the first step in analyzing the geometry of one of these three manifolds. You just kind of figure out what the short curves are. And then once you figure that out, you need some kind of inductive discussion to understand how the hierarchy structure fits into the geometry of the three manifold. So all of that it works, and it gives you various uniform models and so on, but it has this very important, restriction. This is, which, I haven't explained how that comes in, but it's very, you can't really get away from this without paying a high price. So it really uses the pattern injectivity of the surface. So what can we say about the general case? And that leads us maybe to my last picture. So what's sort of the oldest, most interesting example of a non-pi-1 injective surface in a three-manifold? Well, it's a Haygard surface. So every three-manifold can be written as the union of two handle bodies along their common boundary. So this is a Haygard splitting. So you take a three-manifold, you take a handle body, which is just the interior of this surface, you take another copy of it, this is Z and this is W, and you attach the two boundaries by some homeomorphism, and you get a three-manifold. And every three-manifold can be obtained this way, but not in a unique way. There's lots and lots of different ways of doing it to any one manifold. So the study of these things is actually very rich and very active lately, but I want to focus on one particular question, which is the same question. Given such a description, can I tell something about the hyperbolic geometry of the manifold? And here, things are a lot more open. So I don't really have complete answers, but I'll say a couple of things. So sort of, this is kind of a schematic of the same thing. Here's S, here's V, and here's W. How do I start to analyze this combinatorially? Well, the first thing you can do is, the natural thing to do is to look at this surface. So this surface is certainly not pi-1 injective, because there's lots of, because this map from the boundary of the handle body into the handle body is not pi-1 injective. So let's try to get a grip on that. So suppose we look at all, let's call it D sub V. It's all the elements in the complex of curves such that gamma is the boundary of a disk. D is a disk in V. Okay? Sometimes called the meridian set or the handle body set. It's an infinite set of curves in the surface, which are exactly the ones that bound disks on the interior. Okay? So that's obviously important if you're going to try to understand, it's an important topological object if you want to understand this manifold. And the real question is, can we construct the model for M, this manifold, from this data in V, in dV and dW? So you have the complex of curves, and you have two sets, dV and dW, which are presumably different, although not, I mean, there are examples where they're the same, but typically they're different. And can you, from this configuration, figure out what the geometry of the manifold looks like? Okay? And I don't really have anything to say about it, except that, I mean, there's work by various people. So Namazi is another alumnus of Stony Brook, essentially did this for a family of special cases. So if you impose certain construct, for example, you have to assume that the distance in the curve complex between the two sets is very large. You have to assume something about the shortest hierarchy or the best hierarchy for connecting this set to this set. You have to essentially assume a sort of bounded combinatorics condition on this hierarchy, and then you obtain a model for this hyperbolic manifold, which sort of looks the way you might imagine, which is to say, it looks like a long cigar with two ends, where this part looks a lot like a part of the infinite cyclic cover of the thing that fibers over the circle, and then you add two handle bodies to the top and the bottom. So anyway, there's a model for how this looks, but the typical case is much more nasty looking than this, and it's actually quite hard to solve the problem in general. So maybe I'll stop now. I see that I've gone way over. So, thank you. Oh, good question. So, convex set is convex if any two points. So, set X is convex if any two points are joined by a geodesic inside the set. A set is quasi-convex if any two points are joined by a geodesic which exits the set, but only a bounded amount. If there's some bounds. Yes. So for hyperbolic spaces, this turns out to be the same thing. But in general, yes, like right, there's a K, which means the K is this distance. So the geodesic escapes no more than k away from the set where its endpoints lie. Yes, k quasi convexity.
So,
for
this
manifold,
can you
prove
the
I think the easy answer is no. So the model is the model itself is sufficiently it's really made out of Lego bricks. It's not a hyperbolic model. So you know that it models a hyperbolic manifold, but the actual construction does not yield something with a negatively curved metric. So yes, but if you don't know that manifold exists, then it's harder to get something out of it. On the other hand, so I should say that even if this produced, suppose somehow we got very clever and this produced a proof of hyperbolization of these manifolds, it wouldn't really be a new proof because essentially all of the ideas of Thurston's that went into the original proof of hyperbolization of these things are used somewhere in this discussion. So all this theory of pleated surfaces uses sort of all the fundamental ideas that Thurston used to get geometrization. So it's not really, it wouldn't really be a new proof. It would be, you know, somehow you're adding lots of wrinkles to the old proof and then you get the same result in the end. But in fact, it doesn't produce it. It in any easy way that I see, it does not produce a proof of this. Right. So hiding here is this is actually a very good question because there's a gap in our understanding, I think. So, So there is this totally combinatorial construction. You could ask, can I even prove? So here's a question that I don't think I can answer in full generality. Start with the geodesic in the complex of curves and make this construction, this hierarchy, and then do the thing which I didn't explain, which is build a model out of this for the hyperbolic three-manifold. But now suppose you just do this for a geodesic. So is there an a priori proof that the object you want is even delta hyperbolic? You take this, you get this manifold, you get this universal cover. Is it even delta hyperbolic? So it's like a combinatorial hyperbolization theorem. So I don't know a proof of that, although I do know... So I guess in the case where you have this periodicity, this phi, then there is actually a proof of this. Essentially what happens is you appeal to Bestvina Fein. So there's this theorem of Bestvina and Fein, I guess from 1989 or 90, which is like a combinatorial hyperbolization theorem for these things. So they show something more general, but a corollary of what they show is that if you start with this manifold in a Sudarnosov monodromy, then its universal cover is hyperbolic. So, and they do this purely by combinatorial means. So in some sense, you could sort of appeal to that kind of idea here, but then you'd be using those ideas. I mean, somehow, I don't know a generalization of that to the full picture. But it's a good question. No, this is also a good question. So there's this skinning map from the Teichner space of the boundary of a three-manifold to itself, which Thurston uses in his proof of hyperbolization. And this is actually a question I'm very interested in, but I don't know an answer. So an important ingredient in Thurston's proof is that this map from Teichner space to itself has bounded image for a cylindrical manifold. But I don't know an effective bound on this image. An effective bound would, in fact, give you a lot of information about for this question for gluing. So, yeah, that's a good question. For a Hocken manifold, there's this hierarchy, which is a different hierarchy from this, where you cut along incompressible surfaces, and at every step you reconstruct the manifold by some sequence of steps, and in each case you have to use a skinning map for that step. So if you could make each step effective, then you would have some kind of effective control of the whole procedure. But you start with the ball. you cut it all the way down to a 3-ball, and then you start connecting along discs and along. Well, for the 3-ball, it's easy. I mean, well, let's see. So what does effective mean? So if somebody gives you the Hakan hierarchy, you have this, it gives you a combinatorial picture of the 3-manifold cut up in a certain way. The combinatorics of this picture give you, so I'm not, well, I can't go through the whole, well, at every step you have some, what you have is, say, a ball with a bunch of, with a pattern on the ball, and you want to glue up parts of the pattern. The way you do, you use Andreev's theorem, I guess, to know that there is,
so,
no. So this is yeah, okay. Now I understand your question. So I should ask you this question in that case.
I've proven it. Nobody's refereed the paper. Have you implemented anything like that?
I have. I submitted a paper.
No.
Okay.
Not yet.
But you worked out, you thought about it.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh. So you're, wait, so you're, the point you're making is that...
Is the theorem true? The point I'm making is that I think this is quite approachable.
No, but Andreev's theorem is used in the beginning. No, I guess it's used. So you need Andreev's theorem in the general setting. You need it on a general manifold, and you put a pattern on the boundary,
exactly.
And you have to realize that too, right?
Yeah.
Well, you
can build up. You can start with your polyhedra, and just
right.
Gluing them together, you get a priori manifold with a pattern on the boundary.
Right. Right, but that gives you. But so that's not the same as this question. So there's sort of two questions here. One is your Andreev's theorem tells you can build this manifold, but now you also have to understand the deformation space of this manifold, right? So there's sort of two steps that you have to control. So the deformation space. So I'm curious. This is the question that I was. I mean, that's what this chalk is supposed to correspond to. But, okay. No, nothing conclusive. No.
Well, I guess that's a combination that's got to be at least complemented as a general computer representation of Hirsch's theorem. Hirsch's algorithm for rational mass.
Yeah.
And that's been done just very, very sporadically in a handful of degenerate cases.
Yeah.
Programs that work really well.
Oh, really?
Well, I mean, quadratic polynomials work well. If you know that you're looking for matings of quadratic polynomials, there's a program that sort of works okay, but each case is another program. There's no general Kevin Cohen had some ideas, but this would help.
Mm-hmm.
So, can you do it for all quadratic branch covers, for example, and